Good afternoon. I'm Arno DeBorgrav. I direct the Transnational Threats Project at CSIS, and I'm the moderator for today's panel. Very quickly, a few thoughts. When French authorities were trying to get their arms around the internal al-Qaeda threat, they focused on the country's 1,000 most important mosques and discovered that 40% of the imams had no religious education whatsoever. They had simply lifted material from the web, and when asked to point out the websites they were reading, they were all pro-al-Qaeda. We don't have to go over what's happened in the UK and in Germany recently. It seems to me that for years we've comforted ourselves with the simplistic notion that our own young Muslims were born into relatively well-to-do families, therefore immune from any temptation to sign on with internet desperados. Political correctness also led us to avert our eyes from any such domestic problem. The U.S. Army report on Major Hassan evidently failed to mention Islam, Islamist, or Islamic. And today's banner headline on the Washington Post says that G.R. Jane is a new kind of threat. It isn't new. What's new is our willingness, I think, to talk and write about it. Hence the crisis report released today by CSIS. I assume they all have copies? Yes? Well, then I don't have to tell you what the title is. Interestingly, I was reading this morning what Adam Gadan, al-Qaeda's American spokesman, was saying recently, and I saw him also on Al Jazeera when I was in the Persian Gulf a week ago. He pulled no punches when he praised defiant Muslim heroes like Mujahid brother Major Hassan, who has shown us what righteous Muslims can do with an assault rifle and do for our religion and brothers in faith, and has reminded us how much pride and joy a single act of resistance and courage can instill in the hearts of Muslims everywhere. Nonsense, as we all know, but nevertheless, it is broadcast by Al Jazeera, and I listened to it for about 10 minutes. So here we have this wonderful panel to try to sort out fact from factoid, from disinformation, and zero in on five recent events that came under the rubric of homegrown terrorism perpetrated by U.S. legal residents and citizens. And so now we have the four panelists, known, I'm sure, to most of you. Let me tell you quickly who they are. They will speak for 5 to 7 minutes and then throw it open to questions from the floor. In the order of their appearance, we first have Rick Ozzie Nelson, CSIS's Director of Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Program, a former Navy pilot with 20 years of intelligence experience, including assignments at the NSC, where he was in charge of developing national strategy for maritime security, and served at NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center. Afghanistan was among Ozzie's numerous overseas deployments, and he redeployed to CSIS last November. Mark Sageman is among, as you know, the world's top three specialists on Islamist terrorism. His latest book is Leaderless Jihad, Terror Networks in the 21st Century. To mention, of course, all of Mark's academic positions and books written would leave no time to do justice to the other two panelists. Suffice it to say that this remarkable man joined the CIA in 1984 after a tour as flight surgeon in the U.S. Navy. After a year on the Afghan task force, he served 2 years in Pakistan, 87 to 89, where he ran the U.S. aid programs for the Afghan Mujahideen that led to the defeat of the Soviet occupation forces, which led in turn to the collapse of the Soviet Empire 9 months later. So we have Mark to thank, in case you didn't know. After 2 years in India, he resigned from the CIA to return to medicine, and after completing a residency in psychiatry at Penn State, he has practiced forensic and clinical psychiatry, in which capacity he evaluated not 5 or 50, but 500 murderers. Dr. Phil Anderson, with 30 years of experience in government, the private sector, and the policy community, was one of the early bird pioneers at CSIS who developed homeland security policy and stood up our own homeland security program right after 9/11. Dr. Anderson's work helped mold national thinking on how to create DHS to begin with, and most important of all, how to protect our critical infrastructure. He is now director of the Institute for Homeland Security. He's a frequent witness, as you know, at numerous congressional hearings during that critical post-9/11 phase, and then moved on to develop from the ground up and then execute Lucent Technologies, Bell Labs, government business strategy as VP of their Washington operations. Last but by no means least is someone I had the privilege of working with daily at CSIS throughout the 90s on the Global Organized Crime Project, which morphed after 9/11 to Transnational Threats, known as TNT. Today, experts from around the world are familiar with Frank Sulufo's work on homeland security. I was in Pakistan at the time of 9/11. I have got back just in time to bid farewell to my friend and close colleague, as he had been recruited by Governor Tom Ridge as his deputy and as special assistant to the President for Homeland Security at the White House. As the Vice President of George Washington University, Frank leads GW's homeland security efforts on policy, research, education, and training, and directs the Multidisciplinary Homeland Security Policy Institute, what he calls a think and do tank, that builds bridges between theory and practice to advance homeland security through an interdisciplinary approach. Frank is the prolific author of dozens of monographs, some of them we did together, on everything from getting ahead of prisoner radicalization to cyber strategy 2.0, to cybercrime, cyberterrorism, cyber warfare, or how to avert an electronic Waterloo, to combating chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear terrorism, a comprehensive strategy. So Ozzy is first up, 5 to 7 minutes, Ozzy, and that way we, in half an hour we can get their thoughts into this mic, and after that it'll be your question.
Well, thank you very much, Arno. I actually have the easy part because we have published a study, so if you want to know what we think, you can just read the study. Before we go forward, I want to thank, you know, Arno, for you. It's an honor to have distinguished speakers such as yourself here, and then my co-panelists for Adrena did this, Mark, Phil, and Frank, and then particularly to Ben Badurian, my research assistant, who helped author this report. I do want to get into the conversation, so I'm just going to touch on some of the high points in the report. Basically, what we decided, there was a lot, these five cases that we call that last fall of the media was reporting, calling homegrown or domestic extremism. We wanted to evaluate them very in a very rudimentary fashion to kind of figure out, is there a trend or what's going on with these cases? And the five cases we're talking about are the Zazi case, the David Headley case, Hassan case that we're all familiar with, the Somali case, were the two dozen residents from Minnesota, and then the five young men from Northern Virginia or Northern Virginia 5. The details of those cases are in the report, but I'll go ahead and touch on some of the themes. The purpose for holding this panel is not so much to state whether this is a trend, but it's to have a discussion because we think it's something that the American public we need to address and at least have a, as Arno alluded to, have a conversation about because has broad implications for us. What we did take from the study was the fact that we think this is a serious issue, but we think it's a narrow problem. It's not a widespread problem. We do think that there is significant issue with individuals that are U.S. legal residents or citizens that have what we call a duality, which is understanding of U.S. culture and access to U.S. to travel freely if you're under U.S. documentation, and then to understand a foreign culture overseas and to be able to operate overseas very freely as well. And that kind of duality, we think, makes very lucrative of targets for groups like al-Qaeda that are seeking to recruit. And we see, you know, in the case of Jihad Jane, whatever we make of her, that's a perfect example of someone who can be recruited who does not meet our stereotypical ideal of what a terrorist may or may not be. One of the things we did in the report was just look at, is this a Europe case? Europe has been dealing with radicalization, domestic radicalization, much longer than we have. We see the case in the United States is very, very different. A lot of the issues in Europe we see as a result of social marginalization. That's not the case in the United States for the most part. The Muslim and Islamic communities are very well integrated, relatively speaking, and a lot of times are outperform their partners. And there's also what was particularly troubling about the cases for us, though, there was also a remarkable diversity. There was no common template for this, and I think some of the other panelists are going to mention that. They all were recruited by various groups, LET or Al-Shabaab or even Taliban or Al-Qaeda. They came from varying socioeconomic backgrounds, so there wasn't really any particular template. You could say this was the issue. But there are some similarities, and I just want to highlight two of those. That we found, and one is that there was an issue of an intermediary, that these individuals were disenfranchised by some case, and this is a case I think a lot with extremism, and then some intermediary was able to take that disenfranchisement and turn it into action, have them act on those feelings, and mostly this was done via the internet. And at times it was done in mosques, particularly those mosques overseas when those individuals traveled. And then there was also a narrative that almost to a number that they bought into, this narrative that somehow the Al-Qaeda narrative that the U.S. and the West is at Islam. Even when Zazi pled guilty, he said that was one of the reasons that he was going to commit to terrorism. Now, again, so how do we counteract these trends? One, we have to sever these links with these intermediaries and keep this from happening. And two, we must continue to puncture this Al-Qaeda narrative. In no way should we use that. It should dictate U.S. foreign policy. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be smart as a nation and be prepared to counteract that narrative and be more aggressive in our strategic communication. And then how to move forward, just touching on this, some of the things we pointed out that are critical to this is the fusion centers and the state and local relationships. In a lot of these cases with extremism, those that will first identify it will be those closest to those individuals, friends and family members, local police force, those kind of entities. They're going to see the changes in behavior. They're going to see the thing is with the case of Northern Virginia 5, they went missing. The families contacted a Muslim civil rights organization who then contacted the FBI. So it's those kind of relationships, and they're going to understand those communities better than perhaps the federal government will. But at the same time, the federal government has the overarching understanding of the global terrorist threat of Al-Qaeda and these other groups and the linkages that are going to have to be important. And then lastly, wrapping up my remarks, we do believe, again, the Internet remains what we'd call a blind spot in the U.S. government. Certainly, a lot of things have happened since 9/11 to increase the U.S. government's efforts in this venue, but more has to be done. The Internet has to be treated as we'd say in DOD, a battle space, and appropriate capabilities have to be brought to bear on that to ensure that that we're doing all that we can to interact that. And then I think Arno, since he's a distinguished words, and I'll keep it short to 5 minutes and turn it over to my colleague, Mark Sageman.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. Thank you, everybody. Let me kind of go on to what I want to say. Otherwise, I'll spend 5 minutes thanking everybody. All right. First of all, in the last 10 years, just about every terrorist plot has been homegrown. And by homegrown, I mean it came from the West. This is not Al-Qaeda infiltrating the West. These are Western kids going abroad. Some of them come back. The majority want to stay abroad. And this, you have to really make a distinction between the guys who want to stay abroad, a little bit like the Lincoln Brigade in the 1930s. We have to understand why they want to fight abroad as opposed to really come back here to do things. Is there an increase? Actually, there is a slight increase, but overall in 2009, but overall there is a tremendous decrease. The high watermark of terrorism, of plots, Al-Qaeda-type plots in the West, was 2004. It's been decreasing ever since with an uptick in 2009. But you're talking about 5-6 plots worldwide as opposed to arresting people who belong, who want to do things or something like that. Bona fide plots are very few. Then the process of radicalization, it's really a two-step process. One is to join a protest counterculture which is legal in a Western liberal democracy, and indeed I would argue maybe the driving force for the evolution of a Western liberal democracy, just the civil rights movement and women's liberation movement. So protest counterculture is fine. It's not really violent extremism, which I think we should look at because people express themselves in very violent ways, even though they don't do anything violent. It's extremist violence we should focus on. And we have to be very focused, otherwise we may actually increase the number of people who get very upset. That's the first step. It's really joining this protest counterculture. The second step is really rejecting this protest counterculture as being ineffective, having a sense of moral outrage, and then wanting to do more, becoming violent. That's really what we see a little bit in 2009. And I'll talk a little bit about that. Now, in terms of the Al-Qaeda narrative, I really don't know why people keep on harping on that. The narrative is very simple. The West is at war against Islam. That's it. It's a soundbite. I wouldn't call it a narrative. I would call it a frame. Now, the question is, why is that appealing to some people and not to others? That really should be the question. Now, there is also no direct link between ideas and action. We've known now since the 1950s that every idea is mediated through small group discussion. This is a two-step process. It's been popularized in The Tipping Point, but that's been well known since the work of Elihu Katz and Paul Arzasfeld at Columbia in 1955, and that has been, it's pretty robust. It's been demonstrated time and time again. So the key element is really the small group discussion, either on the internet or face-to-face. Okay, now let's kind of look at your list. Jaji, yeah, kind of homegrown because he spent about, 12 years here in the United States, but it turns out that he radicalized in Peshawar. Not so much in the United States. He married in 1986, went back to Peshawar for a long period of time. It was very much in Peshawar that he actually got this idea. Headley and Rana, this does not give us much confidence, because those guys were radicalized, were running around the world for 8 years being militants, and we didn't detect them until 2009. Not a new problem. Major Hassan, we don't know what he is. He's definitely a mass murderer. Whether he's a jihadi or not, that really remains to be seen. And the army has not concluded yet. Basically, he sent 18 emails to Olaki, and Olaki answered two, basically not trusting him. So is he part of a protest counterculture? He wants to be, but he's not really been accepted. We don't really know yet what his computer says, because I don't think the FBI has finished the exploitation of the hard drive. But he's definitely a mass murderer. We don't actually know exactly what led him to what he did. The guys, as I said, who go abroad, whether it's Somali or the five kids from Virginia, that's kind of going abroad to fight abroad. So why is there an uptick in 2009, if you look at it? Well, I would put three different arguments. One is that we're still very much discriminating against the Muslim community in the United States. So even though about 5-6 years ago we didn't really see much of this violence against the homeland, now I guess some of them are losing patience, and the media may have become a little bit more strident in the last year or so, because they object to the government's political correctness. The second argument is that this is tapping into a new market. Those new guys really don't speak Arabic. They're very much English speakers. And what really has happened in the last 5 years is that you have a shift from Arabic language chat rooms to vernacular chat rooms. So French, English, German, Dutch, Turkish. And that has tapped now into a pool of people who were relatively neglected by the global neo-jihad prior to 5 years ago. And that includes the increase in number, usually. And the numbers are not so much increased in the United States, but they are in Turkey and Germany. That's where the increase has come forth in the last 4 years, at least the IJU case and the Turks see as well. Finally, the third argument is that we see that the attraction to the narrative, as you put it, has really lost a lot of traction worldwide. The polls are fairly robust on that. Support for terrorism has decreased, both in the Muslim world, in the Western world, just about everywhere. So why do we see more violence? Well, it turns out that if you look at large terrorist waves, the violence come at the very tail end. And the reason they come at the very tail end is that this kind of social blob, this protest counterculture is diminishing, retracting, is becoming very ineffective. And so people, young Turks, who are morally outraged, who now cannot really legally protest or really reject this form of protest as being totally ineffective, decide to then become violent. And so in the leftist terrorist wave, you know, all the violence came in the 1970s when basically the leftist ideology had declined dramatically, you know, after the high point of 1968. The Baader-Meinhof gang, much of the violence came in 1977. The Red Brigade, same thing. You know, if you look at the Weather Underground here, same thing at the very tail end. So in a sense, perhaps we are winning on, you know, diminishing that protest counterculture worldwide. But what we're going to have because of our success is an upsurge of violence in the next 4 to 5 years of the people who are disenchanted with the effectiveness of that protest counterculture. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Well, thanks, Arnaud, for the very kind introduction. Having spent 2 years at CSIS immediately after 9/11 and having been mentored by folks like Arnaud, I always welcome an opportunity to come back to CSIS. It's more like coming home than anything else. I have a tough act to follow with Mark, but I would offer a few observations, and I think I may be a little more opinionated than Mark, considering the absence of some of the facts in these cases. A lot remains to be seen. I'd like to start by saying that I, as I have always been all the way back to my early days here at CSIS, very skeptical with regard to how significant this threat of extremism is for the United States. We've been dealing with and suffering extremists and extremism throughout our nation's history, and that's not going to change, be that Islamic extremism or extremism of another flavor. It doesn't make any difference. That's the United States, and it's what we stand for, and there are always going to be disgruntled citizens, soldiers, activists of every flavor, and it's not going to change. So we've always been resilient. So I'm skeptical. But does that mean that we shouldn't be concerned at all? No, it doesn't. There are a number of things we need to be concerned about, but I think that the engagement construct that Ozzie and Ben described so well in their paper is certainly something that could be helpful in this regard. It offers, although it's very complex, in terms of involving federal, state, local, and the Muslim community, it is complex. But it certainly is something that I think history has proven can be enormously helpful and can generate enormous success. At the Homeland Security Institute, we did a little bit of research on the 2005 Pakistani earthquakes and U.S. Engagement in Pakistan to support recovery operations there. And what we found was that Islamic sentiment toward the United States, was improved in a measurable way. It was far more positive as a result, and during that period where the United States stepped in and provided enormous relief services to Pakistanis and to Pakistan. But that was episodic, clearly. Engagement, if it's going to be successful, has to be continuous, and it has to be consistent. So I think, again, that this you're on the right track, absolutely, Ozzie, with that engagement construct, at least in defining it. Executing is going to be, in my view, far more difficult, but it's absolutely necessary if we're going to be successful. That said, I'd like to talk about a little bit about a concern that I have related to the way we have, defined extremism. I think we see less these days the use of the term Islamic extremism, but it doesn't matter. It's too late. We overused that term following 9/11, and now we have turned away from that, and we simply say extremism, but the damage is done. We still associate extremism with Muslims. And that's the biggest challenge, in my view, to engaging the Islamic community. They've already been labeled. And, you know, a Muslim that commits an act of violence is automatically an extremist in most cases. If you look at Major Nidal Hassan, in my view, and I agree with Mark that the jury is still out, there's a lot we don't know. But on the surface of it, it would appear that Nidal Hassan was just a very disgruntled soldier, and we've seen that many times before. We've seen disgruntled soldiers and sailors and airmen and go in and into mess halls in Iraq and elsewhere and kill their brothers. We've seen it. Hassan was clearly unhappy about his looming deployment, and he reached out, 16 emails in one case to one imam, but to a new, he went shopping for others. And when he finally found one that at least answered two of his 16 emails, we connect the dots and say that that's an Islamic extremist. Well, I'm skeptical. I don't buy it. I see a disgruntled soldier who didn't want to deploy, and then, you know, we took it. We, as a society, the media, took it one step further. And I think there's a real danger in that. We have to be very, very careful. We have the Jihadi Jane or Colleen LaRose story that broke this morning, and there's a lot we don't know about that. But on the surface of it, it would appear that she was a woman who needed a great deal of attention and found solace in the internet, and you know it. Again, we'll see how it plays out. But the danger is that in all of this, is that we create distance between our larger society and the Muslim community. And if we're going to engage effectively, we've got to close now that gap. We've got to somehow reduce the damage that's been done, in my view, by labeling, over-labeling, and over-characterizing these kinds of things as Islamic extremism. So I'll leave it at that and turn it over to Frank.
Well, thank you, and I will also try to be brief, and it's difficult following such esteemed colleagues and friends, and I might just echo Phil's point earlier. Arno truly is a treasure in Washington and a mentor, and when he calls, I jump. Let me try to maybe add a little color to some of the conversation here and maybe find some areas where I agree and also where I disagree, perhaps. I think if you look at the 2009 cases in particular, it underscores the fact that the threat continues to evolve. It morphs. It comes in different shapes and sizes. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's basically metastasized. If you look at the Zazi case, that is probably the most direct case that we have that has direct linkage to Al-Qaeda Central. Obviously, that is where we've spent most of our time, effort, and thinking as a country. That's where the capacity and the capability is greatest. Obviously, that's looking back to 9/11 as our constant reminder. If you look at the Headley case, a.k.a. David Headley, Dawood Gilani, I think that's one of the most interesting cases we've seen. He was connected to LET. Not part of Al-Qaeda Central, but clearly part of Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations and certainly running in the same milieu of those that share its ideological objectives. Here you have someone who changed his name 2 months before he went to do surveillance in Mumbai, which ultimately was instrumental in LET's successful and meticulous planning that killed not only six Americans, but over 160 other people and many other hundreds injured. Perhaps ironically, given yesterday's news with Jihadi Jane, You also had Headley involved in an attempt, also with conduits and former LET members who were members of Pakistani's military, retired, engaging in an attempt to assassinate the cartoonist in Denmark. I guess cartoons in Scandinavia is becoming dangerous, but... So you have the Headley case, which I think is kind of unique. But again, it shows the fact that you have AQ affiliates that historically did not look to the United States as a target, and whether or not they are strategically looking in that direction or whether or not you have fellow travelers who are exploiting that situation, I think is something we need to look at. Same thing that we saw with our booty bomber over Christmas. Linkages to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. Historically, they were looking within Yemen, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There's also some concern right now with al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. There's been some writings recently that they are looking to the United States as fair game as a target as well. And I would argue AQIM is probably the most sophisticated of al-Qaeda's affiliates, simply because its former leaders of the GSPGC, as well as GIA in the past, have a higher sophistication level than most, and the training and the experience. Then you've got the more wannabes, and here, as Mark calls it, leaderless jihad. These are more the self-enlisted. These are the ones that are inspired by al-Qaeda's ideology, inspired by the narrative, inspired by the message, and to a large extent, they're self-enlisting. And clearly the Internet plays perhaps the most significant role in this space, and it is an ungoverned space and something I'll touch on momentarily. And then you've got the al-Shabaab and the case studies identified here in terms of Americans fighting in, from Minnesota and elsewhere in Somalia. I just came back from the UK, where there too is, as well as most of Western Europe, you have a number of Westerners going over to Somalia. But what's interesting is many are not part of the Somali diaspora. And the reason is, I think, it's easier to get to Somalia because you can get to Kenya without visas and you can slip into the border and you still come back home with the street creds, the jihadi street creds, to be able to further mobilize and marshal indigenous support. So I don't think there is a single, not only profile, but what we're seeing is a metastasized threat. It comes in different shapes, different sizes, and that requires greater vigilance and in terms of law enforcement authorities, we can't just go to what we think we know because it will change based in part on our actions. Let me touch a little bit on the Internet in particular, because I think that is where we probably have the most thinking we need to do and perhaps some of the most difficult policy prescriptions and decisions we have to be looking at. No surprise that al-Qaeda, its affiliates, and the wannabes have placed such great emphasis on the net. As-Sahab, that is their primary means of al-Qaeda Central's ability to get the message out. It's an asymmetric form of media. They can't turn to, from an OPSEC perspective, nor can they own a media capacity, so they've been looking to the net. It has played a significant role in the past in terms of enabling tradecraft, whether it's fundraising, whether it's communicating, whether it's surveillance, whether it's target selection. The net has long been has played a significant role in enabling tradecraft. But I really think it's the recruitment radicalization piece that is perhaps most significant. I differ a little with Mark here because I think the narrative does matter. The old statement, it's the economy stupid. Well, it's the ideology stupid. If you actually look to what is drawing people in, and it's not only making religious arguments, in fact, mostly not. It's more emotive than anything else. It's an emotional draw. It resonates with a small percentage of a population, but that percentage of a population seems to be more mobilized and more open and susceptible to that message. So the question is, what do we do about it? And I think all of us have come to conclude, and if not, please disagree, but I think we have all come to conclude we're never going to be able to kill and capture our way to victory. We're not going to be able to arrest the problems away alone at home. That's not to suggest those aren't, the kinetic instruments aren't important, but certainly in and of itself is insufficient. So how do we, I've sort of got a 3D approach in terms of how we address this. First, we delegitimize the message. And again, it's not so much a war of ideas as much as it is helping enable the narrative fall under its own weight. The noun-verb gap, they say versus what they do. And to be able to do that, you have to dissect it, you have to unpack it, and you shouldn't be pushing it under the rug and treating it as top secret, but rather exposing it more. And so first, delegitimize. Primarily, you're going to need to have, obviously, Islamic scholars make that case on their grounds, on religious grounds, supported by the Quran, supported by the Hadith and other cultural arguments. Deglobalize. In essence, we've united our adversaries when we ought to be disaggregating and delineating and differentiating between and among these organizations, not giving them that that mass appeal, but peeling them off. Think global, act local. Deal with local grievances and recognize that the global message is selling. And then lastly, de-glamorize. Carrie Lamack here in the audience, for those of you who don't know Carrie, she stood up the families of 9/11, and I think the deglamorization message in terms of remembering the victims, remembering the people, the dreams lost, the faces, the stories, and not only of our Western victims, but also of Al-Qaeda's majority Muslim victims. It collides precisely with their own narrative that it's a clash of civilization. So we need to be doing more, and I might note Carrie's continuing to carry that mantle not only through the families of 9/11 but through other work. And I think this is where we got to go beyond government solutions, because it's not a whole of government, it's a whole of society. So these sorts of programs, I think, are instrumental as we look ahead. That said, there's also the need to enhance the pointy end of the spear, and that's the tactical law enforcement functions. I would have argued 3 years ago, as it pertains to the Internet, keep most of these sites up, because the collection benefit was so huge. I would argue today that is not the case. What I'd like to see is something similar to what we've done with child predators and kiddie porn in the past, and that is get it off the mainstream sites. If you turn to Sheikh Google for your facts, I don't want to see Zarqawi's speeches. I don't want to see Zawahiri's speeches. I don't want to see Sayyid Imam al-Sharif's original arguments, which still come higher than his renunciations. So how do we start getting around where if you actually go to Google for your facts, if you're going to YouTube, let's make it difficult for the joyriders who could potentially trip into this and those that are really serious about it, then we can devote our resources in a lot smarter, more effective kind of way. So let's get it off the mainstream. Let's be able to focus our resources accordingly, not only from a collection standpoint, but I would argue from pushing back on the narrative, as well as a convergence of Humint and SIGINT, human means and technical means to be able to address this issue. I can go on and on and on, but the one other, the local flavor is so important here from a law enforcement perspective. Intelligence-led, community-led policing is going to be more effective than anything Washington can do. We still haven't fixed the requirement-setting process vis-a-vis federal, state, local information and intelligence sharing. That's something that should be a prerequisite number one. And I don't know if anyone's familiar with the UK's rich picture approach, but the UK has counterterrorism units, counterterrorism intelligence units. It's sort of looking at the top-down and the bottom-up simultaneously. When you look at the United States, we're improving our capacity from the top-down in terms of intelligence gleaned overseas and elsewhere. But if you actually look at the information that's going to be most useful in not only stymieing radicalization but also identifying potential perpetrators, it's going to come from the bottom up. So how do we get to the point where we have a rich picture in the United States, something we're still not there, something we absolutely need, so we can all get to methodologically sound bases to be able to discuss this issue? And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, panel. Before we get into your questions, let me invoke the privilege of the chair to bring up a subject which bothers me considerably. 2 weeks after 9/11, I found myself sitting down for a very long interview with a former head of ISI in Pakistan, General Hamid Ghul, who hates the United States with a passion. He was the first to suggest that 9/11 was a conspiracy between Mossad and the CIA. Since then, that story has not only grown legs but seven-league boots. It's all over the world. As recently as 3 weeks ago in Cairo, two former Egyptian ambassadors who had spent between them 10 years in Washington, D.C., said that they believed it was a Mossad-CIA conspiracy. Books suggesting that have sold 1 million copies in France, 1 million copies in Germany. I think, Mark, you were, before we came on, you were saying that you've heard this all over the world as well. What is the net impact of all of this? Do people feel that we just sort of went into Iraq and Afghanistan based on a total phony piece of disinformation? Where do you come down on this?
The founder of all knowledge.
It's very disturbing, but, you know, conspiracy theories are pretty common. You know, just look at this town. You know, Obama is a socialist, he's going to unionize the healthcare and so on. So, I mean, you can't really just blame other people. It turns out that the creativity is probably higher overseas than it is here on some of the stories. But, you know, what we have, in a sense, a lot of the stories are promulgated by the Internet. So Frank's concern about the Internet is legitimate. And what we have on the Internet is a crisis of legitimacy. Any 14-year-old can put up a site that's much better than Al-Azhar or, you know, or the Department of Defense or State Department or anything like that, you know, and they do it in a cool way and so on. And as I mentioned, you know, every idea is kind of mediated through discussion. The kind of discussion, the cool discussion, you know, leads to a jihadi cool and the suspicion of the establishment, just like the 1960s. You just don't trust what the U.S. government says. The lead up to Iraq did not help on this one, I must say. You're absolutely right. Those stories are almost unshakable. You know, when I talk to many people, I ask them, "Well, what's your evidence for that?" And you know, they say, "Well, you know, I didn't get it from." You know, strong data, I didn't get it. I got it from my neighbor. And that's what I mean, that every idea is kind of mediated through, you know, those kind of intimate little discussion that people have. And, you know, those, if you are a little bit, you know, skeptical of your own government, you can imagine how skeptical you are about the United States. But we are facing crisis of legitimacy on the Internet, and I'm not really sure how to resolve that.
Thank you. So it's opened up to questions. Please, yes, sir, would you please identify yourself before you ask your question?
Sure.
You got a mic right behind you.
Great, thank you. I'm Mark Randall from the Congressional Research Service. Americans, of course, have a constitutional right to espouse any extremist view, no matter how odious it is. What they don't have a right to do, of course, is to move to violence. The government, of course, then has a right to deal with the violence part of it. The question that's interesting is what can and should government do about the extremist radical view part of the problem that you guys have identified here? So I guess my question is, what can and should the United States do now that it's not doing? And I'm mentioning the fact that engagement with Muslim communities, which is one of the things that Ozzie's report talks about, is currently being done. But what other things can and should the U.S. government do within the constitutional constraints when you're dealing with extremist views, radicalization, and so forth. Thank you.
Is this addressed to the entire panel or to someone specific?
Whoever wishes to jump on that.
Well, I think that a good model for us to look at is the one that General McChrystal is applying in Afghanistan. This is really about winning hearts and minds. It's always been about that. And, you know, we've got to find a way to educate. And, again, it's not an easy thing. It's the construct that's laid out in the CSIS report is very thoughtful, but it's extremely hard to execute. Winning hearts and minds has never been easy, but that's the trick. And we've got to start someplace, and then we've got to apply the necessary resources and let it play out over time. Just as General McChrystal, I think, is realizing in Afghanistan that it's not easy, but. If we're persistent, perhaps we'll succeed. But I think that's a key element to the engagement construct that these guys laid out.
I may take a very much of a minority view on this, but I feel we have to become a little more comfortable with perception management, psychological operations. These are bad words in Washington right now, but ultimately a lot of the activities are going to have to have the overt function, but it's not so much about loving the United States as much as it is about hating Al Qaeda. Those are two separate issues, and I think we've lumped them together. So I think there's a lot more that can be done on the covert side, and also on the overt side. Let's go back to the Cold War as an example. Defectors. Well, we've had tons of defectors of Al-Qaeda as well. I've interviewed many of them and we've written a report with Noman Bin Otman before he became a pop star and some of the others, which I think is a good thing. But how many people have actually read any of the recanting and recantation documents of any, whether it's Saeed Imam al-Sharif, who's probably the most significant as he was a former head of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad and also a personal mentor of Zawahiri's, who wrote two texts that are part of Al-Qaeda Curricula 101, justifying violent jihad as a means to achieve their objectives. How many people in this room here, an informed audience, has read the recantation? This should be plastered in every chat room throughout the world.
All 400 pages?
All 400 pages. Well, that's the way to sleep them to death. I mean, the benefit is Zawahiri spending time writing responses than planning attacks. So I guess there are two sides of that. But there are many other examples. Jamaa Islamiyah. Here they've taken a very different approach than, say, the Egyptians did or the Saudis have. Here you basically turn them into pop stars. They're going around talking to children throughout schools in the countryside, in the places that are most vulnerable to J.I.'s ideology. These should be, again, it can't be government initiatives alone. Ultimately, they have to be grassroots. I'd like a dead Facebook, as graphic as that may sound, of all the victims of Al-Qaeda. I would like them to be remembered. What are their names? Especially the women, the children, and the elderly, as this is precisely in the Quran itself, as off game. So I think of Tookie Williams. Here you had one of the primary gangbangers in the world, still was put to death, but before so, he was able to speak to young men in Los Angeles who are already parts of gangs or potentially susceptible to gangs to say, hey, this ain't the lifestyle you think it is. This isn't theory. This is not cool. People die. Your future is limited. So I think there's an awful lot more that can be done. On the hard side, the policing side, we've barely scratched the surface domestically in terms of major metropolitan police departments. Outside of NYPD and LAPD, maybe a little Miami, a little Chicago. There's a lot of information. There's just not a whole lot of knowledge. And how do we start looking at these sorts of initiatives to be able to get to that requirement-setting process? This isn't sexy. It's basics. It's meat and potatoes, but it hasn't occurred yet. So you got a lot of plasma screens. You got a lot of fun toys. You got a lot of gee whiz neat names, but there's really not a whole lot of knowledge. You go down to the law enforcement community, who I have the greatest respect for, few of them could say much about Al-Qaeda. So how do we get to bridge that gap, enhance the analytical capacity at state and local? So I think there's a lot more that can be done, and I'll leave it at that.
I think Ozzie would like to say something.
Just to touch on a couple additional points along those lines, I completely agree with Frank. The other issue, I think, which is now in the debate, is how to treat terrorism, and I believe very strongly that you need to treat it as criminals, their crimes, as I think Mark said, or Phil, that he's a mass murderer. That's who San was a mass murderer. And that's what one of the things we're going to use to help these communities maintain dialogue with the U.S. government is so that they understand these individuals are going to be treated within the rule of law. And that has some risks, and some people don't like to hear that. But if you don't treat them as criminals and subject them to the rule of law that we've established in the United States and that due process, individuals may not be so willing to come forward and to turn perhaps friends or family members in for fear that they won't get due process. And I think that's an important thing. And then just to hit on, I continue to be flummoxed that the United States has failed so miserably in the strategic communication realm. I don't even know what strategic communication is. I know we're not doing it.
Not well.
I just don't understand why we cannot do that. We are the world leaders, arguably in media, and our culture is our greatest expert in many ways, and we can't control the dialogue, international dialogue, at least influence the dialogue. I get flummoxed by. And Mark, good to see you again. But lots being done on the state and local. But I think Frank touched on this, and I'll just hammer the point home. It's not enough. When you talk to LAPD and you add terrorism or issues of terrorism to their suspicious activity reporting list that they have to go through, the list goes from 15, 20 to 25 to 30 items, when in LAPD, terrorism is not high on the list. If you're the chief of police in LAPD, terrorism's like probably 7 or 8 after crime and drugs and white collar, all kinds of other issues. So that's where they do, I think, greater influence from the input from the U.S. government and doing it bottom up and giving them the resources so they can do what they otherwise can't. Thanks,
Mark. Did you want to say something? I'm sorry.
Yeah, let me be my usual contrarian self here. I agree that perhaps we should engage a Muslim community, but on the other hand, I feel very uncomfortable with it, because by engaging the Muslim community, you're actually singling them out and you're differentiating them from normal U.S. citizens. I think that we should treat everybody equally, in a sense, and perhaps not really kind of focus, we're not looking at Muslim, but we are, by having an engagement policy. That's one aspect. And I'm struggling with this because I think that there needs to be a dialogue, but in a sense, it's starting to work. Because if you see some of the cases, recent cases, it was really the community that was the first people who pointed out to their own organization, who then went on to point out to law enforcement or the FBI that something was wrong. So in a sense, things have improved, not to the extent that we may want to, but I think that the debate has been frozen about 5 years ago, and there's been major, major improvement in this type of engagement. Now, the things about not to do. It's having an engagement from the federal level. I'm not really quite sure that it's a federal level policy, and definitely not a counter-terrorism policy. And the guys who are engaging, the Muslim community in the federal government are NCTC and the FBI. Those are the last people you want them to engage. I mean, just think about it. Not only are you singling them out, but you are singling them out because you suspect they're terrorists in the first place. So, you know, you can see my sense of immigration. But, you know, something can be done locally, and I think this should be done locally, and the best way to deal with this is to have local law enforcement authority to be reflective of the local community they police. So if it's 20% Muslim, the police force should be 20% Muslim. Those are the guys who are going to really pick up if there's something wrong within their own community, and being staff policemen, they'll be able to do that. That has not been done. The NYPD, to my knowledge, is really the only one that's really pushing to really recruit more Muslim within the local law enforcement authority. But anyway, those are my, you know, I'm a little bit ambivalent about that.
Thank you. I think Phil wanted to add one word before we move on to the next question.
I don't think we disagree as much as you may think, Mark. I think we've already alienated the Muslim community. And I think a key element of the process of engaging the community has to be to reverse that. The other thing I would say is I'm a little bit confused about the role or what the role of local law enforcement ought to be in the counterterrorism domain. I mean, this is the skeptic in me. We don't have a big problem here in this country. That's not to suggest that we won't at some point down the road. But I, for one, am far more concerned about criminals and other public safety kinds of concerns than I am with terrorist acts in the United States, particularly with what we know is a weakened al-Qaeda and an al-Qaeda that we hope will continue to grow weaker.
Could I just one word, because it bugs me. It's not a Muslim community. It's communities. There's not a single monolithic community. It's going to take and that is part and parcel of how we respond, and I very much second the local law enforcement, as I think you know, Mark.
Thank you, Frank. Next question. Yes, ma'am. Could you identify yourself? There's a mic right behind you.
Hi. Sandy Swarzbach from the Air Warfare Center at China Lake. This is a question mostly for you, Mr. Salufo. When you're talking about delegitimizing the message and getting Islamic scholars involved in helping out this, is that happening? Is there a way to get that involvement going on? Because I haven't seen a lot of that. And deglamorizing the message, are we able to do that? I'm not seeing a lot of that happening. And then a follow-on question for Dr. Sageman. If we are winning and you're going to see more violence in the next 4 to 5 years and that's going to start declining, then what's the next wave after that that we get to look forward to? Thank you.
Firstly, on the delegitimize, I mean, part of it is the defectors themselves to be able to speak out against their one-time organizations. But, yes, you do have Islamic scholars out there. The Yaman message, you had thousands of imams come together, ironically, the eve of the 7/7 bombings in London. But they came together renouncing violence as a means to achieve jihad. Do we have enough of that? No. Can we do a better job packaging that as well? I mean, reminding people. Why isn't there a website where all these are brought together? Actually, save that. That's going to be my next grant. But in all seriousness, I hope people do that, because yes, you need to bundle that. Is there enough, though? No. We'd obviously like to see more. On the deglamorization, I think you're sitting next to the woman who's doing more than I could ever do in that effect. Now, one of the things that bugs me, though, and I've had a couple pieces on this, is we all know the names of the people who are the suicide bombers themselves. They're lionized. They're made to be heroes. They're martyrized. That's wrong. That's the backwards way to look at this. So I'd like to see more, but I don't think that's something the U.S. government should necessarily run. That's something I think the United Nations and other entities can give legitimacy toward. But ultimately, it's NGOs. It's going to have a local flavor because it's going to have a local effect and impact. It's got to be grassroots. What I'd like to see, though, are these efforts bloom all over the world and not not one-time deals. And I'm not suggesting these are one-time deals, but more needs to be done there.
Next. Yes, sir.
Let me answer.
Oh, Mark.
Yeah. Let me actually say the delegitimization. This is going on. It's very active, and that's why within the Muslim community, support for terrorism has decreased dramatically. You know, the newspapers don't report that 1,000 imams condemn terrorism. They do report the one, you know, morons who's an outlier there. We kind of say, you know, jihad is great. Well, that gets a front page of newspaper. So this is really more of a media strategy as opposed to what's really happening on the ground. And the fact that some parents have now, you know, said that they're worried about their kids, that shows how much the legitimization has really gone down for this type of thing. In terms of glamour, I think that the best deglamorization would be former jihadis to really tell what the situation is like. I think that Frank and I were in Saudi Arabia about a year and a half ago, and you know, some of them were very effective, especially that guy was totally burnt, that I still remember. But yeah, you know, going to the Fatah is not about fighting, it's about diarrhea. You know, that's what you get. I mean, it's waiting, it's bad food, it's really being sick, and most people come home, you know. But that's the reality of the situation, and more people should say that. Okay, now what's the wave after? Unfortunately, I think the next wave is going to make those jihadi look a little quaint. My fear, and you know, you can see it rising, are the kind of fundamentalist environmentalists, Earth First, Gaia. You know, we're ruining the world, we're ruining the Earth because of pollution, global warming, and in order to save the planet and preserve the human race, you may have to kill 80% of the people because, you know, what's really ruining it is overpopulation, and the only thing that can kill that efficiently are biological weapons. This is a call for biological weapons. You know, they're clean, they're nice, you know. And you already see that on some extremist website, and this is really scary. I mean, you're talking about 5 billion people dying here, you know. So I'm not trying to minimize the impact and the loss of 3,000 people, which is a horrible tragedy. 5 million is really an order of magnitude that's really quite different. And so that's my fear. I hope it never happens, but that's my fear.
So your next mic right next to you.
My name is Fez Rahman. I'm from Voice of America. And basically my question is directed at Mark. Mark, you got a lot of credit for the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan, and you've been involved yourself. So actually, I just want... Well, basically, I want you to have a look at the historical roots of extremism. Do you think it had a dramatic impact on the Muslim population when the Soviets fell? Basically, what they thought, a lot of extremists are to be extremists. Basically, they thought that now that they downed one giant, they can take on another. And basically, it's not just the narrative that the West is against Islam, but it's the other way around as well. They just want to. So, I mean, to create a counter narrative, I mean, do you want to have a close look at the roots of that extremism? And some of them, we talk about deglorifying, de-glamorizing, and delegitimizing the message. So some of that stuff should fit in that narrative as well. So what's your comment? First Mark, and then, of course, everybody else, please.
No, I did not train bin Laden. This is always asked of me, so, you know, I'm kind of putting it out there. I never met the fellow, and we didn't have any contact with foreign fighters. Now, you know, in a sense, this neo-jihad, and I call it neo-jihad because it's not jihad. A lot of people have commented that, you know, jihad is rule-governed. You don't kill, you know, non-combatant. You don't kill women. You don't kill children. You know, these guys do without batting an eyelash. So if I don't call it jihad, nobody would understand what I'm talking about. So I call it the global neo-jihad. You know, it's about hope. And so, absolutely right, because the Afghans are illiterate and did not write their own history, the foreigners wrote that history and claimed that they fought the Soviets, where they did not. There was one skirmish in Jagiali Hill in April of 1987, 20 on 20, basically, and, you know, they did pretty well. You know, half of those guys died, a lot of the Spetsnaz died, but the Spetsnaz were not going to control this area, so they left, and you know, the guys, the 10 guys left, screamed victory, and that was broadcast all over the Muslim world, and that's really what made bin Laden famous at the time in 1987. But that's it. That was the only skirmish between the foreign fighters, what you call the Arab Afghans afterwards, and the Soviets. They did not do any fighting as a group. So a few of them were scattered among Massoud's forces, some Gulmuddin Hekmatyar, but mostly Abdul Rab Rasul Sayaf. So they broadcast because they were the one, they were foreigners, they had access to their own media, as opposed to who the hell cares about what the Afghans think, and nobody speaks Darien Pashto anyway in the world. They do speak Arabic, and those guys, of course, claimed that, hey, we defeated the Soviet Union, whereas they didn't really do much. But that did gain quite a bit of traction in the Muslim world, and so that gave them hope and said, gee, we defeated one superpower, well, we can defeat another one. I think that Frank mentioned Norman Ben Atman, and, you know, Norman was around at the time in 2001. He was around bin Laden, and he can tell you that at that time they thought that the U.S. was just a paper tiger. You know, you just can have one blow, and it's going to be like Beirut 1983. So, as I said, it's hope. It's, a misrepresentation of what we were. It's a vast, miscalculation. But that did play a role, in the legend. I wouldn't call it a narrative, but it's a legend of al-Qaeda.
Meryl Smith, Independent. I'm wondering, would it be helpful if we had a less interventionist foreign policy? I mean, in particular, our military engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you could also extend that to our presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia and any number of other places around the globe. You mentioned Lebanon, 1983. We pulled out of Lebanon. We haven't had much of a problem since.
We talk about this in the paper, and Al Qaeda has been one thing about Al Qaeda. They're very clear about Al Qaeda Corps, at least, is very clear about what their goals are, and certainly the U.S. presence in Muslim lands and U.S. support for apostate regimes has been one of two of their underlying tenets that they've perpetuated. Now we look at our presence in Muslim lands, so to speak, after September 11th, it's greater than it was prior to September 11th. So we kind of play into that. He set up a pretty brilliant, ideology there when he puts those out there. Again, I don't think that the U.S. should, dictate its foreign policy based on, what Al Qaeda's, strategy may be. But again, you have to take it on. You have to counter it. And again, we've been unsuccessful with that. And you look at, the Iraq War, and not to, to revisit history, but, it goes to U.S. credibility, and, the Iraq War undermined a lot of that. And that's one of the issues, with Afghanistan. We have to define what our goals are in Afghanistan moving forward and the role of Pakistan. Putting, additional troops into Afghanistan, is that going to solve it? Is that actually going to get us to where we need to be? Arguably it won't, unless we counter that. And Iraq and Afghanistan aren't the future of how we're going to, defeat these threats, because Frank's correct. We have to maintain a very strong hand in this. We have to maintain the ability to reach out on law enforcement and in military and in covert action to take these terrorists head on when it's appropriate. But that's not going to be done in overt means. So when we talk about North Africa or East Africa or the Arabian Peninsula, it's got to be, has to be a small footprint. It has to be, preferably, it has to be done in tandem with our partner nations, those countries that are very subjected to extremist violence, such as Yemen or in Pakistan. We have to support them across a broad spectrum of issues, not just military support, but you have to do the economic development. I think we made a critical error by abandoning not only Afghanistan after 9/11, but Pakistan. We cut off aid to Pakistan because they developed a nuclear weapon, which in their eyes was to counter India. We may not think that that's legitimate, but at the end of the day, when we cut that aid off, we broke down a relationship and maybe disenfranchised a whole generation, or at least a half of a generation of Pakistanis that I think we're feeling some of the repercussions of now. So, you know, clearly to, the report says we caution against large-scale military intervention. We don't think it solves the issue, addresses it, and we wouldn't disagree with your point. I'm not sure if any other panelists want to comment.
Yes, Phil.
The Defense Department, many of you may be aware, just released the Quadrennial Defense Review. And one of the cornerstones of that, going back to this whole notion of engagement, is engaging, not only those that are our allies, but our potential adversaries across the world, across the globe. And they make a very strong case. It's definitely worth worth the read, why we need to engage and why we need to move away from this perspective that we intervene rather than engage. And I think that's a key point.
Yeah, Emily Goldberg from Total Intelligence Solutions. This is for all of you or any of you who choose to answer, I guess. I'm just wondering if you can address the issue of Islam in prisons, and if that, after the December 25th attempted attack, there was a lot of talk about 36 former American prisoners in Yemen training with AQAP. I'm wondering if that was overblown by the media, or if that's something that, we'll actually face a threat from in the near to medium term.
The so-called radicalization in prison is a pretty complex topic. It depends very much on the social structure of the prison and how the prisoners are kept. It was a huge problem in France and Spain, not so much here. I'm not sure about it. Yeah, I saw that report too, but I'm a little skeptical. It's like if you remember when the British raised the threat level right before the conference on Yemen and Somalia, CNN called me 3 times about the story of plane loads of burqa babes carrying suicide vests about to land in Britain. And they believed the story. I'm sorry, they did, because it was a Friday night and they kept on asking, are you sure you don't know anything about it?
I think they called me after they called you.
So, it's not... I'm not making this up. Thank you for supporting me on this. It's the guys who are jihadis who go to prison and are mixed in with the general prison population are really rock stars in prison, and therefore can have disproportionate amount of of influence on the other prisoners. And, the major problem happened in Spain, where they not only released them freely, but they gave Muslims a whole wing to the prison where the guards did not go in. And I remember when I interviewed some of the correctional officers in Spain, they said, it was like... the old Reconquista in Spain. You had the Moors on the one side and you had the Christians, So that was a problem. And it spawned an actual plot where they wanted to blow up Judge Garzon, Baltazar Garzon's office later on, the Ashraf case. But since then, the Spaniards basically spread them out, isolated them, so they kind of prevented other people from being, from communicating with them, and therefore, in a sense, solved their problem. The French also had that problem, but the French have more of a problem because a majority of their prisoners are Muslim in France. But they're still trying to isolate them. It's not as great because a guy like Safe Bourada, who was arrested in 1995 on the wave of bombing in the French metro, was able to radicalize a few of his colleagues, and that was another case. And those guys were arrested later on. But usually it's not as bad as people think. It turns out that prisoners are pretty cynical and they're not usually susceptible to, after they release, to become jihadi. So in a sense, we call it Prislam. prison Islam, because they very much radicalize in prison, and then when they release, they go out to, you know, they're just petty criminals, and they forget about Islam, and you ask them, well, what happened? How come you did not follow? And says, well, that was prison. Now it's real life. So it's not as much of a problem as people think, but, you know, you have to look at the social structure of the prison itself.
We did do two long studies on radicalization in the prisons about 5-6 years ago, and more recently. And to Mark's point, charismatic leaders are ultimately and it's hidden around a veil of religion, so even those that are recruiting, by and large, it's a significant set of issues, but I don't know. I don't think we have the capacity to know how significant of a threat it is, because when they are released, by and large, parolees, we don't have information on what they do afterwards either. So in terms of the AQAP, and there also been some talk in Somalia as well, very specifically, I'm not sure what the answer is there, but one thing to keep in mind where I may disagree a little with Mark is prisons have long served as incubators for radical views. I mean, Adolf Hitler wrote Mein Kampf behind bars. Joseph Stalin filled the ranks for the Bolshevik Revolution behind bars. Zarqawi went into a Jordanian prison as a two-bit thug, came out head of AQI behind bars. And the list goes on and on and on and on. And if you actually look at some of the European cases, many had been in juvie, in penitentiaries for juveniles as well. So I'm not sure any of us know exactly, because – you know, 92% of our prison population is not in federal prisons. It's at state prisons, county jails. They're dealing with gang concerns every day. Talk about lack of linguistic skills. There are very few language skills outside of the Federal Bureau of Prison, but you go to the state and local. I'm not sure we can evaluate accurately at this point.
Next.
Hi, thank you. Rafael Marquez from the International Security Program right here at CSIS. Just wondering if you could comment on the increasing utilization of police informants, especially in infiltrating some of the social networks. We saw it in the Fort Dix plot. We saw it in the Bronx synagogue plot. And the some of the realization that the informant is actually playing a facilitating role in the plot, and a lot of controversy that's got. If you could comment on that. Thanks.
It's about the role of a confidential informant by the FBI in kind of promoting their cases. It's actually very troubling. You know, they used to be called agents provocateurs, and this was very much the way the Cheka used to, you know, eradicate the radical left, mostly the anarchists in Russia before it became Soviet Union. The French did the same. The name is French. It goes back to the 1830s. I was surprised that the FBI had recourse to it. Now, the problem with that is that you don't really know what those kids were going to do without the confidential informant, and often more than one, you know, who are pushing the case along. And when the Jaji case broke out, if you remember, you know, most people in the bureau said, oh, this is very different. This is a real case. That means that all the other cases are entrapment. I mean, of course they won't say that. But they're smart enough to realize that there's a problem. Now, the real problem comes in when you try to understand how a plot unfolds over time. You almost have to throughout all those cases, because they're not clean, so you don't really know. This is, you know, the guys who are driving the plot are right here in the Hoover Building in Washington, as opposed to, you know, we don't know how a case would unfold. And so to be analytically pure, to really see what the real threat would be, like the Najibullah Jaji case, you almost have to put those aside. This is typically, you know, the U.S. case, because we have a lot of people in counterterrorism, probably more people, maybe 1,000 to 1, you know, in terms of folks looking at counterterrorism to any single terrorist in the country. Whereas in Europe, where the problem is a little bit more acute, they don't really have this luxury to do that. So you don't really see too many confidential informants on those cases. I think the Spaniard tried one, the French tried one, but that was about it. The Danes tried that. And the problem with those cases are that when you try to prove that this was a real terrorist case, you know, the jury becomes very skeptical. And there is a lot of difficulty in convicting those folks that had this confidential informant. The Liberty City 7, which became Liberty City 6 and Liberty City 5 because they kept on dropping those cases, the Miami case, well, those guys were not even Muslim. But finally, they were convicted on minor charges. But, you know that the case stinks if it takes three trials to convict people. So, you know, in a sense, I think it was a little bit overkill on the part of the Bureau to facilitate some people to go to the end of a plot, because most people get frustrated, they say some nasty thing, and then, you know, just like somebody cuts you off on the road, you know, you curse the guy and then you go on, you can't forget. And that, I suspect, would be the majority of the cases. So, you know, it's a little bit difficult to see whether those guys would have gone on or not. And I think that you're raising the question tells me that you probably have as much problem with those cases as I do.
It remains for me, yes. One more.
Phil, Dr. Anderson, I mean, you talked about this. You're skeptical and you don't think it's such a large threat, local extremism, local terrorism. But, I mean, my question is totally different, actually. Do you think it has turned into an industry for a lot of people, maybe? Like, you know, not just here, but worldwide, there are a lot of people who are prospering on this idea, the whole idea?
I wouldn't be here otherwise.
I agree absolutely that it has become a cottage industry. But at the end of the day, to what end? You know, it's a lot of information, but I still don't see the real threat, manifesting itself in any significant way. That, to the extent that, you know, we need to be concerned about, in the near term anyway, about, you know, the harm that can be done to us. Now, the long-term situation, and I absolutely agree with Mark on the bio threat. I think it's the threat that gets the least amount of attention. And I think it's the one, quite frankly, at this point in time, because it's not a hard thing to do, that needs to get the most attention. So certainly, over the long term, I'm not suggesting that I am skeptical. I've been skeptical from day one, and I've been fortunate the last almost 9 years to be proven right in terms. And I'll tell you just a quick story. After 9/11, you know, when I got thrust into this environment, much like Frank. The media was breathing down my neck. You know, we understand you're an expert. I said, no, there are no experts, and it'll be years before we ever have experts. Well, you're good enough. You know, when's the next attack coming? And I said, I don't know, but I'm very skeptical that it's going to come anytime soon. And all my colleagues said, oh, right after Thanksgiving, sometime around the holidays. And then when the holidays came and I asked the question, oh, well, they're on an 18 to 24-month planning cycle. So I waited the 18 to 24 months. Okay. You know, could it be that, it's the American way to overestimate our enemies? And I suppose that may not be a bad thing. But at the end of the day, there's not a bottomless pot of money. There's a limit to how much we can invest. And what we have to do is we have to invest wisely in countering these kinds of threats. And I go back to the whole notion of engagement, especially the point about alienating the Muslim community. I think we've already done it. I think we, through engagement, need to reverse it and somehow win the hearts and minds that are going to help us ensure that this doesn't become the threat going forward that it isn't today.
Now you know why we do not call our specialists experts. Experts is a two-syllable word. X is a has-been and spurt is a drip under pressure. So we thank our panelists.